Welcome to a brand new episode of Back Pass with Russ. And we're back, not after a long time this time, but we're back again with a collaborative episode with our friends from Malaysia, the Bola Bola Show, and representing them. I've got Steven John. I've got two guests today that are, you know, specialists in this subject that we're going to speak about. We're going to speak about South American football. I think many people in this part of the world, we are all, myself included, we are all very Eurocentric in terms of football, European-centric. A lot of our focus on European football. Our knowledge about South American football is limited to what we see in the World Cup or the players that play in the European leagues. And Copa America, if we have ever watched it, I have. But, you know, I don't know about our listeners and viewers if they have watched it. But yeah, that's where our knowledge is limited. But I have guests who have knowledge beyond that. So it's great to have with us on the show for the, I don't know how many have time now. Steven John from the Bola Bola Show. Welcome, Steven. How are you doing?
I think Steven is maybe he's more of a regular guest in your show. This is my second time that I'm on the show.
Javier, I'm gonna introduce you, not to worry. So let's go, Steven first. How are you doing, Steven?
Hey, Ras, how's it going, man? I'm doing fine. Very excited to be in this episode. And can't remember how many times, but yeah, I've been several times. So
can yeah, say we've, that, we've collaborated on maybe about three or four episodes now.
We've done. I think we did twice on the Euros.
We've done twice on the Euros, twice on the
World Cups episode. And then last year we did twice for the Malaysian football in the 90s.
Malaysian football. Yeah. So yeah, we've done six at least now, six collaborative episodes. Yeah. So yes, returning for the second time. Okay, Steven is a big Argentina fan. Returning for the second time on the show. The first time he appeared was to speak about AC Milan in their glory days of the early 90s, and 90s period generally. Is Javier Young. Mr. Young,
right.
How are you doing? A big Brazil fan,
doing
as you can
good.
See from his colors.
Okay. Yeah, thanks for inviting me back on your show again. So, and given like tonight's topic is about South American special, and given that Steven is an Argentina fan and I'm a Brazilian fan, so I would expect maybe there could be some banters or some along the way as
yes.
The shows go. Because it's obvious, because my joy is his misery. His misery is my joy. So
well, I have to say that in the 90s and noughties, it's a lot more misery. But lately, it's been a lot of joy.
Yes. Of course. I mean, what goes around comes around. So lately it's the reverse. I think, yeah, you have a lot of joy. I have a lot of misery.
Yeah.
Okay, that sets us up nicely. So we'll talk about Brazil first. Both of you have put it up very nicely. Brazil in the 90s and the noughties, they won two World Cups, 1994 and 2002. Javier, what's the difference between the 1994 win and the 2002 win?
Okay, First of all, in 1994, there was a lot of expectations and heavy pressure for the team to bring home the cup. Because the last time they won it is that was in 1970. So come 1994, it's like there was a period of 24 years where Brazil hasn't won any World Cup. So there was really a lot of expectations and pressure on them to win, especially when Tele Santana Sao Paulo team. I think we will come a little bit more about that later in another section. Yeah. But the Sao Paulo team under Tele Santana was doing very well in the early 90s. So especially in 92 and 93, where they won both the Copa Libertadores and they also won the Intercontinental Cup by beating Johan Cruyff's Barcelona and Fabio Capello's Milan team. And well, seven players on the 94 Brazilian team have in some point at their career played for Tele Santana Sao Paulo. So you can say that Tele Santana or the Brazilian team of 1994 was kind of like, there was a heavy focus based on the players that played for Tele Santana Sao Paulo team. Mm. And then on top of that, there was also this added motivation to win. I'm not sure whether you're familiar with Formula One. Even if you're not, you would have heard of the name Ayrton Senna.
Yes.
So he was, I would think he was the greatest Formula One driver Brazil has produced. And just about slightly a month in May 1994. He died in a car crash or on race day. So there was this added motivation because Senna was an icon in Brazil. He was a huge sporting icon in Brazil. His legacy in Formula One is kind of like equivalent to Pelé's legacy in football. So after he passed on, the whole country was in mourning. The government declared 3 days national mourning for Senna. So there was also this added motivation that they want to win this cup for Senna.
Okay.
So entering that World Cup, they also have a group of players who were, I would say, they were at the right stage of their careers, who are capable of stepping up in big matches and making a difference. You have players like Romário, Bebeto, Jorginho. Those players are at the stage of their career, or maybe at the right time of their career, where if you need them to make a difference and step up and make a difference in big matches, they are the players who can make a difference. So of course, they went on to win the cup, and then I think everything just falls into place, and they went on to win the cup. And after the final, during the celebration, they really held. They have a banner, kind of like paying tribute to Senna with a message like, "We won this together, and the fourth title is ours." So at the end of the trophy celebration, they did pay a tribute to Senna.
Okay.
So
is it also fair to say that the 94 team was a bit un-Brazil-like in terms of their playing style?
Yes, in a way, you can say that it is quite un-Brazilian-like, especially when the knockout phases commence, because Payet, who was the playmaker, and then the player who was really the one that provides the creativity and flair, he was sacrificed for Mazinho, who is more of a defensive player, because at that time, I think once the knockout phases begins, the pressure to win was huge. And so the coach, Parreira, at the time, he had to sacrifice the bit of flair and creativity for a bit more defensive solid. So that's why he made the switch once the knockout phases begins.
Okay. Would you also say that Romário and Bebeto carried Brazil to the World Cup?
Yes, that's for sure. I think in terms of for the two of them, I think they scored like 8 out of the 11 goals that Brazil scored in the tournament. They contributed 8 goals. So without those two, definitely Brazil wouldn't have won the cup.
All right. Okay. There was quite a bit of symmetry in that final also, because Italy had Baggio who carried them to the World Cup. So
yeah,
but that's a topic for another day. So 2002 then.
2002.
This is more Brazil like, this team.
Yeah.
But leading up to the tournament, not really going good for Brazil, right? It was a bit dicey.
Yes. It was the opposite, because in 94 there was a huge expectations and pressure for them to win, and they entered the tournament as one of the favorites. But in 2002 it was the other way around. So first of all, they did not have a very good qualification campaign. They struggled during the qualification rounds, and at one point they were even in danger of not qualifying. So they've gone through 3 different coaches during that qualification campaign, and they only qualified on the final match day 18, by beating Venezuela. So during the qualification so-called matches and all that, there were a lot of struggles. They've gone through 3 coaches, and before the appointment of Felipe Scolari, or Filipão, as he's more commonly known in Brazil, some of the coaches, I think they also approached Zagallo. Zagallo didn't want to take up that coaching spot, because nobody wants to, put it this way, nobody wants to be the first coach to kind of like not qualify to any to leave Brazil, and then don't qualify for the World Cup. So this kind of like this dubious honor of not qualifying for the World Cup. No, so nobody wants that. So in the end, they went with Filipão, and he was not a popular choice at that time, because again, his style. Okay, he was a successful coach, because he, before taking over the national team, he led 2 Brazilian clubs to win the Copa Libertadores. The first was with Grêmio in 1995. Then second was with Palmeiras in 1999. So he knows what it takes to win. He's a winning coach. But his style of play at that time was, the Brazilian fans considered his style of play ugly, or maybe in Rasinho was un-Brazilian. So So his style of play is not something that appeals to the mass Brazilian fans. So he wasn't a popular choice. But I think based on his credentials, he was appointed. But in his first match as coach, Brazil lost to Uruguay. So in his first match, there are a lot of fans. Yes, his first match as it was a qualification match, and Brazil lost to Uruguay. So a lot of fans were then calling for his head and all that. Okay, so how could you appoint this person? But subsequently, I think he managed to kind of like get them to qualify on the final day, and so the team so-called went on to Japan and Korea without any expectations of there wasn't really any heavy expectations of them to win the trophy. And also when the final squad roster was out, again, a lot of people, including me, was very unhappy because we felt that he didn't select the best players available. So a lot of good players were left out on the roster. A lot of Brazilian fans at that time wanted Romario, even though he was already 36 years old at that time, but he carried Brazil through. I mean, even though Brazil was struggling during the qualification campaign, Romario carried the team through, even scoring two hat tricks during the qualification. So a lot of fans wanted him, but I think Felipão at that time, okay, he looked at his disciplinary record and all that. Nope, I'm not bringing him. And also, despite of the fact that okay, I mean, now looking at that roster has four Ballon d'Or winners. So the three R's plus Kaká, so you have four Ballon d'Or winners on that roster. But was it a good roster? For me, no, because I felt that certain players were not selected, like Alex D'Souza. He should be on the team. He was not. Giovanni Elber, Mario Jardel, and then Serginho for Milan. I think Russ, you would remember him from all the Milan derbies and all the havoc he was causing to Inter. Yes, okay. So Serginho, Jardel, Elber, Alex. For me, these four should be on the team, but they are not. So I was not really very happy when the roster was. But ultimately, it didn't matter because bottom line is Brazil won the competition, and they won it by winning all seven games. I mean, which is up to now the only country to win the World Cup with a 100% record.
And then
Jimmy,
was
I think
there
you
more?
mentioned, I mean, you
Yeah,
mentioned the
please.
name Mario Jardel and Giovanni Elber, but I never felt like they were proven for Brazil at international level. Although, yes, you know, at club football, they were scoring a lot of goals, but at international level, you know, it seems like they were off the mark. And at times I
Yes,
wonder
yeah.
whether if Jardel or even Giovanni Elber would have switched nationality and pledged allegiance to the country that they were based, probably that country would have benefited a lot from them than Brazil could have.
That I agree. But you also have to look at the quality of Brazilian strikers that they have at the time. I think if you look at Ronaldo, I mean, before, okay, he when he was selected for the World Cup, also a lot of fans were skeptical because he hasn't played in 2.5 years. Yes, his knees were like busted, and then people were worried that whether, well, could he even walk? Not even can he walk properly? Not even like play a football match or so there were a lot of question marks over his
And
fitness and
also,
all
he
that.
came back quite late in the season for
Correct,
Inter.
correct. He came back without really any so-called matches under his belt. So he was severely lacking in match fitness when he played his first few games in the World Cup. You could see that he was really severely lacking in match fitness. And interestingly, I think before Brazil went to Japan and Korea, they played their last friendly game against Malaysia. They won 4-0.
I was there.
I'm not sure. Steven, did you attend that game?
Yes, I was there. I was there.
Okay, he was there.
How's that game? How's that Brazil looking like? You know,
First
do you think that
40.
point Brazil will go on to win the World Cup, Steven?
The thing is, you have to remember that World Cup was brought forward rather than being held at the usual time. So it started quite like somewhere around end of May. And the reason they did that because they're,
Yeah,
you know, the
early
month of June
first
and July
May,
is a rainy
if I'm not
season in Japan
mistaken.
and Korea. And that didn't really help for a lot of teams, especially the European teams. That's why you could see that a lot of the heavily European-based side were struggling at World Cup and many upsets and many of them got home early because they were basically playing on their knees by the time came the second and third game. They didn't have enough rest to recuperate and recover in time and to be fresh for the World Cup. So, you know, that's partly one of the reason why that World Cup became known for so many upsets, and many of the countries that went far didn't necessarily rely a lot on European players, or perhaps their players didn't really go far in many of the European competitions. So, that was really a major factor. But as coming back to the friendly game, well, the first 45 minutes, the scoreline was 0-0. It's unbelievable, even till today, to think about it, that Malaysia, put aside Brazil, put
Yeah,
aside Brazil is
Brazil
struggling,
scored
World
us for
Cup, put
45
aside.
minutes, right?
The
Yes.
fact is still a Brazilian national team with a
Yes.
Ronaldo, a Rivaldo, Roberto Carlos, three names that I can guarantee tell you that when the names were announced, fans went wild. The other names, almost many fans here in Malaysia, they didn't know. They didn't know who Cleberson or Gilberto Silva,
Yes.
because he hasn't
Or
signed
Gilson,
for
yes.
Arsenal yet.
Yeah.
Yeah. So obviously, when Roberto Carlos' name, the decimal point was going up, Rivaldo went a little bit higher than Ronaldo. I don't have to say lah. I think you all can imagine what it was. But to keep them in our pocket for 45 minutes itself is a huge honor, man. I cannot imagine. I cannot imagine that. But of course, the final scoreline.
I wasn't there. Yes, I
Of course.
wasn't there in person, but I watched the match and all that. And in the first 45 minutes, Brazil were I don't know. I couldn't even recognize that it was Brazil playing against Malaysia.
Yeah. And I think one of the privileges I can say in this game is the fact that we've got a chance to see Kaká for the first time. Then we got a glimpse of what the world can expect from him in years to come. That's a privilege I'll take. That's the same privilege I will take even when talking about the Argentinian youth team from 1997 when the World Youth Cup was held here. Because before the world got to know the likes of Aimar, Riquelme, Walter Samuel, Cambiaso, me, I saw them first. I knew what was expected from them, what they could become in the years to come. That's a privilege. And th those were great times for Malaysia, having able to chance to bring all these unknown gems that most of the world were not ready for.
Right. Agreed. All right. So, Javier, just to sum it up, 94 team was a bit un-Brazil-like. 2002 more Brazil-like on the way to the triumph of the World Cup. Is that right? Fair assessment? Yes, I think for the 2002 team there was a little bit more flair, but in terms of tactics, it was also quite un-Brazilian. Like if you look at how Filipao played the team, he played with three central defenders
Three,
and
five,
then
two,
two
yeah.
wing backs. Correct. So Brazilian teams, well, they tend to play with a flat back four, but I guess also the pressure of winning the cup got into him, and then he played with and he decided to go with three central defenders. Of course, whether you considered Lucio a central defender, that's another story. Because whenever he had, I think from you as an Inter fan, you would know whenever he gets the
Yeah.
ball, he likes to just
Just,
venture
yeah.
forward. Yes, correct.
Bamboozle
So
everyone,
whether,
yeah.
yes, so he's like a crazy horse. Once he gets the ball, well, okay, the first thing he do, he doesn't care about, he just runs with the ball, he just carries the ball forward.
Yeah. All right. So in this period, there were some World Cups that Brazil did not win. Was there any World Cup that you felt they should have won this, but they didn't? Or you had high, heavy expectations that they should win this one?
Okay, if you ask me personally, I will have to go with 1982, but I know
I know you would say
for your
that.
show, yes, you are probably covering the 90s and
Yeah.
the 2000s and all that, so I won't go really that in detail about the 1982 team. But my personal opinion would be 1982, and that was my first World Cup, so a lot of usually, I think people always say the first World Cup is usually your most memorable. So
Yes, yes.
yes, that was really a very memorable World Cup for me. Even though Paolo Rossi gave me a very miserable childhood, but that was still a very, very wonderful World Cup for me. So, but back to your question, I would pick the 2006 team. Okay, the
Okay.
2006 team on paper, that was a strong team, probably even the best team in the 2006 World Cup. And also prior to going to that World Cup, they won the Copa America in 2004, Confederations Cup in 2005. So they have a group of players who knows what it takes, who knows about winning, who knows what it takes to win an international tournament. But in reality, a lot of the players on that team were picked based on reputation. For me, I find that a lot of them were way past their prime, and they shouldn't be on their roster. Cafu is one of them. Roberto Carlos is one of them. Even Ronaldo is one of them. So for me, if I'm the coach, I would not have picked these three players. But in the end, they are on the team. And also, the strange thing is that Ronaldinho at the time was the best player in the world. And the way he played at Barcelona, he was really like, there's nothing he couldn't do. But yet, when at the World Cup, he somehow, you just felt that he didn't show up at the World Cup. I'm not sure what happened to him during the World Cup, but my guess is because, I'm not sure whether is it because of a lack of motivation or is it because he was a gassed after a long season. You have to remember, during that season, Barcelona reached the Champions League final and pretty much he was playing in almost every game and he didn't really have a rest. So he could be selected for the World Cup and he was feeling gassed in Germany. That's why he didn't really perform well in that World Cup. And then, of course, in the quarterfinal, Zidane just took them off single-handedly. I mean, that was really, I think, one of the best performances I've seen from Zidane. He just took out Brazil on his own.
Okay, so that's the end for Brazil now. Let's move to Argentina. So, Steven, lots of talents in the Argentinian teams in the 90s and the noughties. So a lot of talents that I love watching, even for Brazil as well, for that matter. But why didn't Argentina make it to at least another World Cup final after 1990?
Well, I think a lot of strange decision and of course, at times, luck was not on their side. For example, like 94, I would say that the team, at least during the World Cup, in the first two games, they looked very promising. They could go all the way and win it.
Yeah, they were
but,
scary.
You know, but when the issue with Maradona happened, and followed by Caniggia's injury, you could see that the morale of the team was somewhat a bit down. But nevertheless, you know, even in the game against Romania, if you watch back the whole game, like I did many about, I can't remember when it was, I think during the pandemic, because since you had all the time, you had all the time in the world. So I just wanted to look back at that game. Even though to some extent the narrative was that Haji was running around, but it wasn't really like that. If you go back and watch the game, you could see that Argentina had their moments, had their chance, they could have scored, they, you know, could have at least pushed Romania a little bit more and won that game. But again, you know, I think a lot of the disruptive element, the way the coach prepared the teams, and once you lose two key players in Maradona and Caniggia, it really is a lot of hole to dig in. Of course, 98, you know, I mean, again, the silly thing did by Ortega, and then followed by that magical goal by Dennis Bergkamp, can't argue with that.
Yeah.
Because even that World Cup also, after knocking out England, you know, I felt that we were looking very good. I mean, there was that time I was wondering whether if Argentina in the post-Maradona era were able to do it again. Because if there's one thing you need to understand about Argentina is that there's always this one person that needs to deliver. It's all there's always this narrative that comes in within Argentinian football folklore about that one boy, that one kid that needs to deliver. And Maradona was that kind of player. He was that mythism,
I
that
think
kind of player.
I kind of agree, or I get what Sivan is trying to say. It's like it's maybe like one person has to carry the team and then the rest are just to play like a supporting cast to him.
Yeah.
In 78, it was Mario Kempes. In 86, it was Maradona. And then the latest one, it was Messi. So that one person carries the team. The rest are just like supporting or role players just to support that star player. Yes.
Yeah. In fact, there's a book, I think if you guys get a chance, you can look for it. It's called Big Holes to Fill. It's a book. It's the writer was actually solely focusing on Argentinian football, about this expectation about one player that needs to deliver come every World Cup. And of course, in 2002, as mentioned, you know, the condition going into the World Cup was not very good, very ideal for Argentina. Even though we had a very fantastic qualifying round, but, you know, leading to the World Cup, there were a lot of injury concerns. Many players just recovered. And then, you know, within a short space of time, once the season was over and the World Cup started, you know, the players just didn't have the legs to carry on the job, especially when you are managed by someone like Marcelo Bielsa. The expectation, you know, to run on the field with, you know, that locomotive kind of run when you don't
and
have
in
time
the
to recover
humidity as well.
In the humidity. I mean, that's another factor, yes. 2006, well, you know, again, you know, that's one of the most bizarre decisions made by Jose Peckerman of substituting, Riquelme for Esteban Cambiaso when a hungry Messi was on the bench waiting to turn things around. But even that game against Germany, before we conceded the goal, before we got, you have to remember that a keeper, Torsten Frings, injured Pato Abbanizeri. And that changed the whole game because after that, you know, forced to make another substitution. And that it was right after that only that Mario Miroslav Klose scored the equalizer, and you know, you could see that moment onwards things were not going as you would expect them to be. 2010, well, I don't even know where to start.
Let me just pause a little bit for 2006, because I remember that team very well. In terms of, in the group stage, they were pretty impressive. Even the media were hyping them to be champions, especially after they beat Serbia 6-0.
Yes.
And then, yes, they were really pretty. I mean, they were winning, and they were winning playing very impressive football. So at the time, I was also thinking, that was one of the teams that could go all the way to win it. So my question here would be for you, Sivan, would be whether, let's say, assuming if they beat Germany in that shootout, is that team, could they beat Italy in the semis? Because they would have gone on to meet Italy in the semis.
Definitely, definitely. We've been keeping Italy in our pockets for a long time already.
Yep. I can see last 3 years, yeah?
Yeah, we've been keeping Italy in our pockets for a long time already. I mean, again, you know, the expectation, of course, will go even more higher. And you can never know what can happen in the semi-final. I mean, that Italy team was also a team coming of age. I mean, sorry to divert a bit, but if you look back at the 2006 World Cup, it almost as if like it was meant for Italy to win it, because that
right.
group of players, you know, I think for all the struggle they've been through in 2002, 2004, it was their coming of time to be crowned as champion in 2006. And if you can see, because right after that, you know, everything about that team, the players just wasn't there anymore. So I think, you know, in many ways, that World Cup was deservingly meant for Italy to win. But
if you look at history, like Italy can only win the World Cup whenever there's some scandal in their country, because back then there was this cultural police scandal. Back in 82, when Italy won, there was also some scandal. You know, Paolo Rossi, the hero, he was banned because of match fixing, and that he was banned for 2 years, and then he was just recalled back. His case was also a little bit like Ronaldo in 2002, when he was recalled back. He doesn't look fit. He was missing. He was out of action. He was banned for 2 years because of match fixing. And then he couldn't deliver in the first few games. And then, but when it comes to the match that mattered most against Brazil, that's where he starts scoring. And then he became a national hero.
Back, yeah.
Yep.
Yep.
All right, Steven, on Argentina, was there a World Cup you felt that, you know, which you felt Argentina should have gone further, or at least won that World Cup?
I don't know. A lot of people will argue this against me, but I always felt that 2002 would have been our best ever chance. Okay. If under the right circumstances, if only the World Cup was rather not held in Japan or held in a normal circumstances like any other World Cup before, and the players were not injured, not carrying all kinds of injuries before the World Cup, I would have felt that World Cup could have been our glory moment. Although many people tend to argue back with me and say 2006 was a far better team. The reason why I'm saying this is because I'm still not convinced yet with the 2006 team whether or not they have enough international exposure at that point to really be a credible team to win a World Cup. By the time they reach Germany, when they perform, yes, you know, you can see the odds were going in their favor. Just a little bit of that unlucky decision against Germany and the circumstances against Germany and all that. But 2002 team, right up going into the World Cup, you could feel like this team is destined to win it. In fact, going into the World Cup, Argentina and France were joint favorites. They were arguably, in that 4 years between 98 and 2002, the best ever international football team.
Yeah.
France were, they won the World Cup, champions. They won the Euro, all right? And then, of course, at the same time, you had Argentina who were, you know, once the qualifying started, they started rolling all the way until the end. And, you know, the players at that time were at the peak of their career. Batistuta was scoring at Roma.
They were
Crespo.
The first team to qualify from the Common Ball group. And then they qualified with, I think, five, 6 games. Correct.
Yep.
Five, 6 games remaining. And Brazil were like struggling, but they were the first to qualify, and they qualified really like five, 6 games in advance. So that Argentina team was really very impressive.
Yeah. You know, and Veron was at the peak of his career. You know, it was a very solid team. It still hurts me today that what happened in 2002, to be honest, at times when I look back. So, yeah, that would be, these two teams would be my pick. 98, I'm not too sure, honestly, because I think Passarella's team, that it was, I mean, if you look back at Passarella's team, it was somewhat very similar to the 2002 teams, but Pasarela team was just coming of age. They were just getting into this whole international football thing. They qualified for it, but I don't think they were ready yet just to win a World Cup. I think they needed a little bit more time. So yeah, this will be my take. And of course, 94. I mean, if nothing happened, everything went according to plan, probably they would have won it as well.
Yeah.
Do you think that the Argentina's national team coaches, like putting too much faith in Batistuta, is also one of the reasons that they couldn't win the cup? Because, okay, from my observations of Batistuta, he seems to be someone who, okay, I'm using a term from American sport, which is called stat padding. So his statistics look very good, but somehow his goals are always against weaker oppositions. And also when things are going smoothly for him. So when it comes to big matches or when it comes to maybe in terms of adversity, he just couldn't deliver. So I don't know whether or not if the coaches put their faith in someone else other than Batistuta. Say at that time there was like Crespo. I think for Crespo has scored a lot of goals in big matches, or even someone like Diego Milito, who is also known to be a big match player. So instead of relying your goals on Batistuta and say switching to say maybe Crespo or Milito, would that make a difference?
You have to remember that Batistuta was a prudent goal scorer in Serie A. At that time, it was considered the best league in the world. So, you know, for any national football coach to drop him it's suicidal.
Yeah.
If you deliver, fine. But if you don't, the X will come at you. So I can't blame the national team coaches at that time for relying heavily on him. But what I would say is, though, Bielsa, if he was creative enough, he would have able to start two strikers up front. But because of his strategy that only has place for one number nine, that I think worked against in his favor, especially when the European oppositions, England and Sweden in 2002, played a very defensive game. So he was in a situation where he was man-marked by two centre-backs with no one to cover him in the middle. That was my biggest major concern when I look back at during those times. But I would say he's still a prudent goal scorer. Yes, you can argue that he never delivered in some big matches, but bear in mind that, you know, it was his goals that delivered back-to-back Copa America for Argentina in the early 90s.
Yes.
So those were very important as well. And, you know, even though, yes, you know, you could argue that you scored hat-trick against Greece and Jamaica, but when you are a top striker, you are expected to deliver goals. And, you know, goals is how you define how good a striker can be.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So he and Crespo coexist, let's say, in your opinion? Can he and Crespo, let's say, if were to play like a twin two-striker role, can they coexist?
Yeah, those are one of the what-ifs in football that I don't think we have an answer. We will never have an answer. Yeah.
Yeah, so if I were to name a World Cup that I felt Argentina was really dangerous, 94 was the one. Because when the way they started that World Cup, they were scary. They were a scary team. And then after that, of course, they dropped off. And 2002, I remember they were the favourites to win that World Cup with France. Probably Italy were like second below them or something, but they were also one of the favourites. But that made that World Cup, as a neutral, it made that World Cup very interesting because the favourites all got knocked out. But yeah, for me, that one is for Argentina. For Brazil, 98 was scary. I felt the 98 Brazil team was scary. And if they had Romario, I believe if Romario was fit for the 98 World Cup, it would be a different story. Brazil would probably have won that World Cup.
One thing you need to take note, take note of Argentina during that era was the youth football that they had. It delivered five World Youth Cups and two Olympic gold medals. They were at the peak when it comes to what we like to think of football factory. They were really producing the talent. And even a certain Oliver Bierhoff, when he took over the job as the general manager for the DFB in trying to overhaul the German football system after the disaster in Euro 2000, he was looking for some kind of formula of trying to revive back German football from the top to bottom. From the bottom to all the way to the top. And he actually approached Roberto Ayala, who was that time, I think, his AC Milan teammate, and asked him about, you know, what is it that you guys do back in Argentina that you can able to produce so many young talents? And he actually went there to study, you know, and focus on a little bit on how Argentinians grassroots youth football was and bring some of those influence back to Germany. And the result was, of course, years down the road, You saw Germany producing all this Mesut Ozil's Khedira and all Toni Kroos and all these players. I sometimes look back and think, although not much of this has been said or written anywhere, but I like to think that South American football played a huge role in revitalizing German football in that era.
Okay, so now something more lighter. Passarella and his long hair band. What do you make about it when you heard about it? I think that resulted in Argentina losing a very good player, classy midfielder in Redondo, because of that long hair band.
Redondo was in his prime at the time, and Argentina really missed Redondo, especially in 1998.
And also, I always remember, in the 90s, Argentina players all had this rock star hairstyle, and they look so macho, the hairstyle, long hair. Really, it stood them apart from, other nations. So then came Passarella, like a army military, a military sergeant. He said, that's it, no long hair. If you want to play for the Argentina national team, you got to chop your hair. So what do you make about that?
Well, when Passarella came, he came here at a time where he was trying, at least this is what Tim Vickery, the famous South American journalist, was trying was try was explaining in one of his podcasts. He came in with trying to clean things up within the Argentinian team national team setup, because he was there in 86, but he didn't make it to the World Cup because he was having some stomach issues and all that. And till today, he believed that some of the players actually were the cause of it,
Spiking.
because he wasn't really gelling well with the entire team. He wasn't getting along well, and even between him and Maradona, there was a little bit of personality clashes. So when he came on board in 94, it was just at a time when, the drug issues with Maradona and Caniggia as well. So he was trying to clean things up. So he went through a strict dictatorship personality, and even for a couple of years, Batistuta was not even called up for the national team, because he refused to, cut his hair. But eventually, when you start to seeing a striker scoring goals in Serie A, the best league in the world, it will be calamitous if you decide not to bring him to the World Cup. At some point, I think he also need to give in a little bit. And, of course, eventually, he did had a team that qualified for the World Cup, and he took them to France 98. So that was his agenda, lah, basically, when he came into the national team. There were times I wonder whether if he stayed long enough, because I felt that after 98, maybe the job was still not done yet. If he stayed long enough, maybe, things would have been a lot better in 2002. But that's another whole different story, lah.
All the ifs and buts. Okay, guys, now, Javier, Brazil Argentina, this rivalry, intense. We know it as an intense rivalry.
Right.
Which match in this era? You didn't play, you only played once in the World Cup in 90, but
Oh, it's a
beyond that,
memorable one. One match I'll never forget.
for you,
Yes,
yes, for you,
yes.
yes, certainly. But
For me, no. I remember.
You've
I
played
know
in
which one.
the
The
you played each other in
1990, the 1990 second round. Yeah.
Copa America, Confederations Cup, all these friendly matches, I guess, even qualifier, World Cup qualifiers as well. Which is the most memorable Brazil Argentina match for you, Javier, and
Okay.
then Steven for yourself?
For me, I would pick the Copa America final in 2004.
Oh,
I'm
okay.
not sure whether Steven has fond memories of that final, but I do. Okay, heading to that final, because that if you okay, Rasa, if you didn't watch that match, go and watch it, because it was a drama really from all over. It was drama from beginning to end. So that match, it was a Copa America final, and Brazil playing Argentina, so you would expect a lot of drama, a lot of fireworks. So Argentina took the lead. That match, full time, it finished 2-2, and on
Oh,
both
yes,
occasions,
I remember.
Argentina took the lead, and on both occasions that Brazil equalized, they were both in stoppage time. So in the first half, Argentina took the lead. Brazil equalized in the stoppage time of halftime, with a header by Luizão, and then late in the second half, I think it was like in the 87 or 88 minute, Delgado scored a goal, and everybody at that time thought, okay, that was the winning goal, and all Argentina had to do at that time was just to run down the clock, which I felt Carlos Tevez did a great job at time wasting, but somehow in a deep into injury time, Diego just hit a hopeful ball into the box. It wasn't even a good cross or a good ball. It was more like a hit and hope, and then hopefully that ball landed in some Brazilian player, and really the ball landed, the
Adriano,
ball
right?
somehow got to Adriano. Yep, he just turned around, bang, and that's it. The game went into penalties because in Copa America there is no extra time. So if the match finished level after 90 minutes, then it goes straight to the shootout, and Brazil won that shootout 4-2.
Okay, Steven, yourself?
Well, there's a few. Of course, 1990 is definitely the most memorable one for me. I still remember the game was during a midweek game, and it was quite a late kickoff, if I'm not mistaken, around 10:30 or 11 o'clock, if I'm not mistaken. So living under a strict grandmother, I was not allowed to watch any World Cups during weekdays. By 9, you're in bed. So I did exactly that, except this time I was keeping myself awake, waiting for the lights to turn out, everything, and then everybody was asleep. Sneaked out of my room on the TV, but without sound, I watched the entire game, living with two minds, trying to keep an eye if anything's happening behind the house, with anybody start to wake up, and focusing on what's happening on TV with the game. Honestly, the build-up towards the game, I was a bit nervous and a bit concerned because you have to remember Brazil were in a much better form. They won all their three group games.
That's right.
And Argentina, you know, breezed through the last 16 as one of the third best teams. To one of the four teams to finish in the third place in the group. And it
They
wasn't
weren't
really an
expected
ideal situation.
to meet so early. Yes,
Yeah, it
they
wasn't
weren't
really
expected because
ideal.
based on based on the seeding, Argentina. I mean, if Argentina finished top in the group, then they won't meet in the second round. They were not
Yeah.
expect to meet so early.
Yeah. So at the beginning, of course, Brazil were dominating, but as the game continues, you could start to see Maradona was becoming himself again. He was starting having control over the game and that as well. But you know, Brazil still had chances, numerous chances, hit the post a few times. You know, I think
Three
they tested
times. Three
three times. There
times.
you go. Tested Sergio Goycalo on several occasions. And
Yes.
you start to keep asking yourself, like, how long can this go on? You know, and wait a minute, this is a knockout stage, which means it's not
Yeah.
just 90 minutes. You still, if it's
Extra
draw, you
time.
still have to go extra time.
Yeah.
Honestly speaking, I mean, I was really stressed up already, trying to, you know, focus. And, you know, a few times I could hear the door at the back, like, hey, somebody's getting up quickly off the
Oh yes. Oh yeah. Yeah, I've seen that
TV.
before.
So, okay. And then that one magical moment, like, when I saw Maradona running the ball, I remember looking at it, feeling jaw dropped, but not sure what to make out of it and what's going to happen. And then that through pass, which went through. Mauro Galvão, I think, was the player that got nutmegged by Maradona, and Caniggia was just freed between him and Taffarel, rounded up Taffarel and scoring a goal. I wish at that time, you know, I could s enjoy the goal in a normal situation by able to scream, shout, and do like what a normal football fan should do. But if I do that, then practically speaking, I'm in dead shit trouble already. So, you know, I try to keep myself calm, keep myself focused, just wait for the game final to go off, went to sleep. Of course, the next day, when my grandmother was trying to wake me up, it was a bit difficult for me to get up because lack of sleep and all that. But somehow or other, I knew I was going to have a good time, a wonderful day in school after knowing what happened, that result. That was definitely one of the most memorable results.
There was
Another.
also, I think, the thing back to this game, there was controversy around this game.
The holy
Branco
water?
was saying that, yes, the holy water incident, he was saying that the Argentinian bench passed him a water bottle and then he drank, and then after drinking he suddenly felt dazed, and then so the holy water incident.
But
So I'm not
you have to remember, it's holy water. God was in his presence. Of course, he's going to feel this.
Oh, that's nice. Okay. All right, let's
Another
move on to other nations now.
one I need to
Okay.
share was
Yeah.
97 during the World Youth Cup.
Okay.
Because I mean, again, Brazil were a far better team going into that quarterfinal. And Argentina, having lost to Australia in the group game, a lot of people were not giving hope. And of course, in the round of 16, we knocked out Michael Owen, England, but we still had to face Brazil. And believe it or not, Brazil in that World Cup, in that 97 World Cup, you can go and check it out. I think they were winning every games by 9 goals or 10-1. They were virtually whacking everybody. And that was another game also I can never forget because it was Brazil all the way until the last 10 minutes before a certain Lionel Scaloni, which I don't know, somewhere down the years, I heard he's going to win World Cup, like, I heard he's going to
Yeah.
put everybody in their shoe, in their place, like, win a World Cup. So he was one of the goal scorer, including another guy called Perle Zindo. I mean, of course, as you know, when it comes to youth football, not everybody makes it. Some, yeah, you know, gets loose off the radar. So yeah, these two games are very memorable. And 2008 Beijing, the semi-final game.
Okay, so let's move on to the other nations that we saw emerge at the World Cups. Talk about Colombia first. So of course, Colombia, for me, I didn't watch 1990 World Cup. It's too early for me. Because my first World Cup was 94. So 1990, of course, you've seen images. I didn't watch it, but of course, after that, you've seen images of Rene Higuita, the crazy man, goalkeeper running out of the goal. And one thing that stood out of that Colombia team was their hair. The players, the hair, Rene Higuita, Valderrama, another guy called Lionel Alvarez. So this one stood out for me, their appearance. And then 94, leading up to the 94 World Cup, they hammered Argentina 5-0. That made the newspaper headlines. And I was, wow, this team, man, Colombia, what a team. So it was,
and it was in Argentina. That 5-0 victory wasn't in Colombia. It was in El Monumental, which is River Plate's home ground. So that match happened in Argentina.
Yeah, that's even worse for Argentina. And then, you know, going up to that World Cup 94, you like say, okay, this team is a team to watch. We've got to watch this team. But when they turn up for 94 World Cup, they were a disappointment. And I think generally in that period, Colombia had this a lot of hype around them, especially in the 90s, and then they disappointed. So you guys, talk to me about Colombia. Tell us about Colombia. Then we'll go to the other nations.
Well, Colombia to me were the quintessential team of the 90s. Not only the hair that you mentioned, but also the color of the jersey.
Yeah.
You know, it sort of fit that era. It sort of, you know, you can imagine what was it like. Of course, you know, when Colombia arrived in 1990, it was at the era whereby the country's football was dominated by what was called narco football. You had all these cartels owning the football clubs. Yes. And although they were technically using the football clubs for money laundering purpose, but they really invested a lot of money into the football, which gave birth to a generation of talented players like the names that you just mentioned. Rene Higuita, Carlos Valderrama, Alvarez, Andres Escobar, Aspria, and all these names as well. Fernando Rincon, all these guys. Yeah. So 1990, when they came, of course, there was not much people knew about them on a global scale, although in South America, they already made quite a big impression, including with Atlético Nacional winning the Copa Libertadores in 89.
In 89,
right.
Yes.
Yeah. As for the game against
Milan in the Intercontinental Cup, but I remember that team because it was, maybe like I said, with the cartel's money, they assembled a team that is capable of competing in the Copa Libertadores. And of course, Guita, during that match against Milan, of course, he was doing his usual antics. He takes the ball out, he dribbled his way up to the halfway line and all that. So I remember that match, and that was a very good team. And the 1990 World Cup team has quite a few players from the Atletico Nacional team that featured in the Copa Libertadores.
Yeah. And you mentioned about that result, the infamous result for Argentina that happened in Buenos Aires. A few months back, I had the privilege of listening to this podcast called the Brazilian Shirt Podcast. And one of the games that they focused on was particularly this game between Argentina and Colombia. To some extent, you could argue it's actually one of Colombia's greatest ever night in football. But at that point in time, yes. But now when looking back, in the perspective of many Colombians, they feel heavy-hearted because it was a game that eventually led to a tragedy. Because when all that Colombia needed to do was draw or maybe win by a goal or two to qualify, but when they won 5-0, it shoot up, you know, the hype went over the roof. And
Pele even had them as favorites to win
Pele,
the World Cup
I mean,
in 94,
Being the genius when it comes to making predictions, himself.
Pele and you know, his predictions.
Yeah, Michael Owen plays for Man United, yeah. Man. Which eventually he did. But at that time, Pele predicted was wrong, but eventually happened. So And you know, this Colombian team, they went on to arrange a whole lot of friendly games, which they went unbeaten, including a couple of games against AC Milan, if I'm not mistaken, leading to that World Cup. But once when the World Cup came, there was a lot of issues behind the scene. There were rumors that a lot of women were involved going into the team hotels and all that. So, you know, a lot of things were ideal. I think the result got into their way that, you know, the actual preparation of what a football team should do kind of took a backseat. The players were really, you know, in that cloud nine feeling that now they're going to go to the World Cup and, you know, start to dominate and win. But once the game against Romania concluded, that's when reality starts to sink in. And then there were rumors that the players were being threatened back home by many of these cartels who place a huge amount of betting on them to win the World Cup. And if you look back at the match against USA compared to the game against Romania, you can see that the players, when they were going into the field, the body language was very different. And as you know, the eventually it led to their own goal and the tragedy that happened to Andre Escobar. So for many Colombians, sometimes when they look back at that particular game, they kind of wish that, you know, that even if it was a draw or maybe by winning a goal, they would have still qualified for the World Cup. Maybe, you know, the pressure or the hype or the
Expectations would be
expectation would
lesser.
not be that much on them. And you know, things would have been a whole lot different because Escobar was arguably at the prime of his career at that time. You know, he was just about to move to Europe. If I'm not mistaken, he just signed a deal with Inter Milan. And, you know, the world could have seen what a great center back player he was. And the other tragedy of that game, of course, from an Argentinian perspective, was the fact that that game eventually forced Basile, the Argentinian coach at that time, to bring back Diego Maradona, which forced him to put in this rigorous training over the next few months just to get him fit to play for the World Cup. And that's when, you know, he was caught off, you know, taking substance that was apparently, it was okay to be used in America, but it was banned by FIFA, which didn't make sense at all. So yeah, that game, you know, leaves, you know, of course, at that time when for most people, fans, they will look at the result and think of it, wow, what a great achievement it is for Colombia. But now when you look back, you think of yourself, you know, if only that game didn't happen, maybe things would have been a whole lot different on a humanity basis.
Okay. Javier, let's go to another country now, Paraguay. Paraguay came into my conscience because of their goalkeeper, Jose Luis Chilavert. You open up the newspaper, this guy is a goal-scoring goalkeeper. Wow, never heard of that before. You know, for us, lah, at least. I'm sure you would have heard of it. It's quite common probably in South America, but
It's
this guy.
quite common. I think, before Rogério Ceni, he was the goalkeeper which got the most goals, but the record has been overtaken by Rogério Ceni from São Paulo and Brazil. Yeah.
Yeah, so Paraguay, what do you make about this Paraguayan team? Okay, 98, they made their first appearance in the World Cup. Was
No,
it their
not
first
really.
appearance?
No.
No?
They were there
Okay.
in 86. They were there also, I
86,
think, in
okay.
maybe 30, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah.
Okay, so after a long time then. In my conscience, first time in the World Cup. I've not seen them at the World Cup before and not heard much about that, but then this team comes about. 98, and they ran France pretty close in that second round game. You know, in my opinion, I mean, Laurent Blanc scored with like 2 minutes left in the extra time, and that in those days was a golden goal rule.
Yeah.
So if that match had gone to the penalty shootout, I think Paraguay would have beaten France.
Same here.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah.
So the thing about Paraguay is their emergence before the 98 World Cup, their emergence started in fact from the late 80s and early 90s. Okay, the best team in Paraguay, Olimpia, that team reached three consecutive Copa Libertadores final during that stretch. Winning one in 1990, reached a final in 80 and 89 and 91. And the Paraguay, how they play, they are really very compact, very sound defensively. Because if you look at the South America team of the year in the 1990s, so if you look at it the whole decade, and then you look at every season, which players form the South American team of the South American team of the year.
Yeah,
So if you look at the 90s, you will see three consistently, you will find these three names pretty much appearing very regularly. The first is Jose Luis Chilavert, which you have mentioned. The second is their right back, Francisco Arce. Arce had also a very successful career, but mostly in Brazil. He won the Copa Libertadores with two Brazilian clubs, one with Grêmio and one with Palmeiras. which coincidentally is coached by Filipao. So he played under Filipao at club level. The third name, I think
Carlos
you might
Gamara.
have known him because he played for Inter at one period, Carlos Gamara. So these three names appeared quite regularly in the South American team of the year in the 90s. So with that, you could tell that the Paraguay national team, they are really very defensively sound. And in terms of how they play, it's like keep it compact at the back. All we need is just one chance, and then boom, if we score, that's it, we'll win.
Yeah, that Roque Santa Cruz up front.
Yes.
Santa Cruz came in 2002,
Yes,
98 it
yes. I think,
was
yes.
Nelson Valdez. There's another guy called Nelson Valdez.
98 there was who? I remember there was one Argentinian born striker playing for them in 98. I can't remember the name.
Okay. We'll look this up. We'll look this up as we speak. Now, from Paraguay, let's go talk about Chile. Chile, of course. I know about Ivan Zamorano, of course. But then came this guy called Marcelo Salas, and these two, Marcelo Salas and Ivan Zamorano formed this,
Saza or
yeah,
Zaza. How did
wonderful partnership. Wonderful partnership. And again, back to the 98 World Cup. They qualified for the 98 World Cup, and first match against Italy. And Salas scored twice. Baggio scored the equalizer. And was a great game. It was a great game. I think probably underrated in terms of the great games of that World Cup. But yeah, Chile, great game. I in fact remember, I think they played England at Wembley and beat them.
Yes. Yeah, 2-0. Salah scored it twice.
Yeah, so there
Yeah.
you go. Tell me about Chile, Steven.
Of course, the two names you mentioned were the one, I mean, heavily centered around the two names you mentioned because they were the star player. But I think there was also a few other names. Cesar Aya, I'm sorry. Not Cesar Aya was in
Acuña,
Paraguay. There was a
Sierra, Acuña.
Acuña was one of them. The guy who scored a free kick against
Sierra, José Luis
Jose
Sierra.
Luis Sierra.
Sierra.
Yes. Yeah. There were quite a few underrated names in that Chile team. And it's just kind of sad that we could only watch them for one World Cup, which is 98, because right after that, I think they didn't really peak again. So 98 was like sort of like that peak moment for that era.
Okay,
And I think Salas, even
even
though
because
by
for
far.
Chile, if you want to go back to history, maybe even before 98, historically, they were one of they were a pretty strong team in South America, because if you look back in the 60s and 70s, they were like a regular
Yeah, they were
participant
regular there.
in World
Yep.
Cup. And also because back then in the 60s and 70s, there were lesser team playing in the World Cup. Maybe around 16 teams. So to really qualify for the World Cup, you really have to be very good to really qualify from the qualifiers to reach the World Cup.
Battle of
And
Santiago.
also one name, let's say if you ask maybe fans or people who are familiar with South American football, and then you ask them who is South America's best ever defender, more likely than not, you will hear this name, Elias Figueroa, being mentioned. He is a Chilean defender who played in the 60s and 70s. How good was this guy? He was called Chile's Beckenbauer or South American's Beckenbauer. So go and if you guys are not familiar, then go check him out. Go check him, and you will know that he's very, very highly rated in South America.
Steven, the Paraguayan striker, Jose Cardoso.
Yeah, you remember him?
Oh,
Yeah.
Cardoso, yes.
Yeah, that's the one. All right, so Chile done, Ecuador now. Ecuador came in 2002 World Cup.
Ecuador, actually, my first interaction with them, or shall I say, my first time that I knew there was potential in them, was a game against Manchester United, whereby a club called Necaxa forced them to 1-1 draw. There was a player by the name of Alexis Aguinaga, a playmaker in that team, such a wonderful playmaker, one of the underrated playmakers of that era. He was really running the whole United team in circles in that game. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, they also had a striker by the name of Cesar Delgado.
Yeah.
So, with these two
Agustin
guys,
Delgado, right?
Augustin Delgado, sorry,
Yeah.
just and with these two guys, I kind of felt that, if Ecuador could use their home advantage, because similarly to Bolivia, they had an
Yeah.
advantage when it comes to playing in their capital city, which
Three
is,
thousand meters above sea level, so you need oxygen tanks and all that at half time. I think the players, if you are not used to this kind of thin air or altitude, you see half time, the coaching staff will really prepare oxygen tanks for the players.
So I wasn't really that surprised to see them in 2002. I felt it was just the perfect timing for this generation of players to really make their mark in international football. And I think we were quite glad that we had at least another two, three World Cups from them after that. And you can start to see that Ecuadorian football was growing with more players moving to Europe, including a certain Valencia ended up playing in Manchester United. So
And Antonio
it was
Valencia.
definitely, it was definitely a pivotal moment for Ecuador because you start to open up and start to see more. We started to see a lot more from them because I think before that, Ecuador didn't really have that much of impact in South America. In fact, you know, on most occasions, if it's not Venezuela, it's Ecuador, finish among the worst. So, you know, there was a huge surge in improvement. And so that's why when you mentioned about Ecuador, my first impression was watching that game between Necaxa and Manchester United at the first FIFA Club World Cup game, because I remember how good Alexis Aguinaga was in that game.
Okay,
And I got to say
one
about
more reason I want
Venezuela.
to add for Ecuador is was because they qualified in 2002, but the World Cup got expanded from 24 teams to 32 teams
32.
in 1998. So with the expansion of the teams in the World Cup, there is also a change in the qualifying games in the CONMEBOL region. Back then, the games are split into different qualification groups. But with the change in the new World Cup format and the expansion, so the qualification games in CONMEBOL becomes like a home and away fixtures. You play each team home and you play a total of 18 games. So with that, Ecuador has a more. Okay, not only that, the point scoring system changed from 2 points to 3 points. I mean, in the past it used to be, but it also changed the point scoring. So for Ecuador now, in the past they only had maybe like two games to play at home. Now they have nine. And also with the point scoring system now changed to three. So you know how tough it is to play in high altitude. So they have more games to exert their home advantage. And that allows them to gain more points during the qualification process, which again give them a better chance of qualifying for the World Cup. So I believe that the change in the qualification format in CONMEBOL, as well as the expansion of the World Cup teams and all that plays a part too.
And on that note, also Bolivia 94 was were they one of the teams that had this advantage of high altitude?
Definitely, definitely. If you look back at their career, in their history, they won the Copa America twice, or I think they've been to the final twice, both also on home soil.
Correct.
And at
In
home, you know,
97, they reached a final home soil.
and I think Brazilian first ever World Cup qualifier loss was against Bolivia at home.
Olivia,
Yeah,
yes.
so they it definitely had a huge, advantage to their favor. But I think what made what as what. Javier mentioned what I think made it even more impressive that in 94, Bolivia could only do it with a very limited number of qualifiers at home because it wasn't really expanded yet. It only started
Correct,
expand for
correct.
the France 98 World Cup. So it was split into two groups, which means that between the game between Brazil, Uruguay, and one more, if I'm not mistaken, I think Venezuela was another one team. I remember in that group, it was a five-team group because Argentina team was a four-team group. Chile were banned from international football for an incident that happened in 1989. So somehow or other, you know, when you think about it, with that limited number of games, Bolivia made it to the World Cup. I think that's if you it's to me it's really impressive, impressive feat. And I remember going to the game against Germany in the opening game. Of course, memories of Italia 90, what happened in the opening World Cup. So people were really hoping that Bolivia could do a Cameroon, but yeah,
No.
things didn't. I mean, of course, I think playing in a non-altitude circumstances was a
Correct.
reality check for Bolivia.
Marco Echeverri, that's a player that I remember from Bolivia.
And Erwin Sanchez.
Ah, yes, Erwin
They
Sanchez.
call him the Bolivian Platini. So Erwin Sanchez was also one of their so-called one of their outstanding players.
Okay. So
And
now let's talk about the
there was
Copa
another guy who
America.
played for Middlesbrough. I don't know whether you guys can remember his name. He had a
No.
short stint with Middlesbrough.
When? Bolivian guy? In the 90s?
Bolivian guy, yeah.
Yeah.
Very short stint.
I can't remember.
Jamie Moreno.
Okay. I only remember Juninho Paulista.
Moreno, yeah. Okay, yeah, I forgot about him. Yeah, I think as you say, it's a short stint, so not quite memorable. Okay, Copa America, how is it like watching from this part of the world? Because I stumbled across it in 95 after the 94 World Cup. We watched 94 World Cup, 95, June holidays, school holidays. You were just wake up in the morning. I was in primary school, 11 years old. I just woke up, just channel surfing. Not many channels to surf, but yeah, I did some channel surfing, and then ended up this tournament that's going on in the morning
Same,
on
same.
Malaysian TV.
95 was the first time that
I watched
I
it.
like to I like to think that Malaysia had started to watch the Copa America live.
Yes.
I remember following the 93 edition, but it was mainly through the newspaper and just watching some of the results from the our local TV news channels, basically. So 95 was the first time. In fact, it took me by surprise that we were going to show the Copa America. And in fact, if memory serves me well, we even had a Copa America magazine. If you guys remember, in every World Cup editions, most of the local publisher newspapers, they will come up with their own
Yes,
version of a World Cup magazine. We had one
yeah.
for that Copa America actually.
Oh, okay.
So it was groundbreaking to see that finally that this competition is given the respect it's due, because quite often than ever, I mean, as you started off mentioning that, this part of the world is very Eurocentric football. We've been having Euros since the 80s, but Copa America, that was the first time. I'm glad it's still going on. Of course, these last couple of edition, it hasn't been the case, mainly because the tournament tends to clash with the Euro. So I presume it will be the same thing as well for 2024. So need to figure out a different source to able to watch the games lah. I'm sure
Yeah,
there is
and the
watching games.
timing wise, it is also friendly for Asian viewers. It's like 5, 6 a.m., 7 a.m. in the morning. So Early, for
yeah.
people
All
who
the
have
big games
school
are back
or
then,
have
7
work,
a.m. Yeah.
yes. So
Timing
even
was actually not much of an issue because we kind of experienced it in USA 94. We kind of experienced what's it like to watch live games from that part of the world. So we knew that games, if it's a daytime kickoff over there, it's going to be held 2, 3 in the morning, which is very much a European fixture kickoff at night. If it's a late night fixture, it's going to be held in the morning. So we kind of knew that as well. But of course, given the challenges, especially like for myself during the era of being in school, sometimes you have to figure out a way to watch the game lah. You need to figure out, cari jalan lah to
And
watch the
also, I
game.
think, yes, being student at that time, you could watch it on free on local TV
Yeah,
channels instead of
yeah,
like
yeah.
cable or now like streaming services where you
Yeah.
have to pay. Back then, it was all free on local Yeah.
TV.
Yeah. We could watch Malaysian TV from Singapore, and then I watched the Copa America there. And as a neutral, of course, I would support all the underdogs. I won't support Brazil or Argentina. I would support trying to see whoever else. I really like Mexico though, from 94 World Cup. I really like Mexico, but I know they're not South American, but they were there. They were like an invited nation. It more often than not, they were always there in the Copa America. So it was fun. Then Uruguay, we've not spoken about Uruguay because I think in this period Uruguay was underperforming as a nation. They won the earlier World Cups. Two-time World Cup holders, but
They won the 95 edition actually.
yeah, they won
So
the
yeah,
95 one. Yeah, I remember.
I was not I mean, of course, beating Brazil was one of the reasons, but to some extent I was happy for Enzo Francescoli because finally, he can have a curtain call on his career of winning an international football title with Uruguay, because Uruguay missed out on USA 94. So you could start to see that a generation of football fans were going to find that Uruguay a little bit alien to them.
Yeah.
And by the time they made it back to the World Cup was in 2002. So,
Yeah.
you had a generation of players that really, I believe they could have at least featured in one or two World Cups. Gustavo Poyet being one of them, Marcelo Otero, Daniel
Ruben Sosa.
Fonseca, Ruben Sosa. Ruben
So
Sosa,
far.
at least to some extent, he did play in 1990. I think he was there. He was one of the
Yeah,
young,
1990
up-and-coming
he was there.
players. Yeah.
Recoba. Recoba was
Recoba
maybe
in 2000. Yeah.
later, maybe in the late 90s. That's where he really started to become like a prominent player for Uruguay. Yeah, so that's my memories of watching the Copa America. It's beautiful memories. I mean, For me, like I said, it was school holiday period, so I could watch it.
Another point you need to take note is that it was only in since the 2007 edition onwards that, because I think with FIFA, you know, organizing the FIFA calendars and all that, you started to see that a stronger national team representation at the Copa America. Because if I were to look back at Argentina's squad from 2004, 99, 95, it wasn't really the strongest
stronger.
team. There were a lot of names that, you know, skipped out from the tournament and all that. So, you know, 2007 is probably an important tournament because that's when you started to see that, you know, the national team players really committed to turning up to play for the Copa America, and the Copa America being given more prominence than ever.
Okay. Yep. So let's now move on to the club sides. Okay, so we go chronologically. We go with Sao Paulo first. Javier, tell us about Sao Paulo. I think not many people remember too much about Sao
Okay.
Paulo.
Yes.
And even later
if
on,
you
Boca
want
Juniors
to,
also. So I really like your knowledge on this.
So because if you look at Sao Paulo, I think from especially the Sao Paulo team of the 90s under Telecentena, that was really a wonderful team. For Telecentena, I think a lot of people will remember him as the coach of the Brazilian team in 82 and 86, correct? That those the Brazilian national teams under him, they played pretty football, but somehow they never failed to
Joga bonito.
To deliver or fulfill their potential. And so I think by the time when Tele took over Sao Paulo, he kind of like learned from the mistakes of 82 or learned from his previous mistakes. So while his team, he still encouraged his players to play pretty football. I think for him, because he's really he wants the fans to be entertained. He wants the players to play a beautiful brand of football. So he still encouraged his players to play the beautiful brand of football. But defensively, his team become more compact, more disciplined. And a lot of it, I think he started from Sakis Milan, because in terms of how the team defend or without the ball, I can see some similarities between the Sao Paulo team that he coached with Sakis Milan, in the sense that they tend to compress the space and then deny the opposition that too much space for them to play the ball when they have possession. And also that team was really very successful in terms of what they have won. Like they won the Copa Libertadores in 92 and 93, and then also they won the Intercontinental Cup in 92 and 93. And what made the feat more remarkable was that the teams they beat to win the Intercontinental Cup. In 1992, Tele Sao Paulo beat Johan Cruyff's Barcelona, and it was a Barcelona team that has Mikhail Laudrup. It has they have Hristo Stoichkov, they have Ronald Koeman, they have Guardiola, and a lot of other Spanish national players on the team. And the way how Sao Paulo played Barcelona in that match, I remember Müller, who was receiving the ball, and he was standing in front of Johan Cruyff. He did a Johan Cruyff, the Cruyff signature move, that Cruyff turn in front of Johan Cruyff. Yes, I think you can check some YouTube highlights if you haven't watched it. That time, Barcelona took the lead, so Sao Paulo was trailing, and then that was the move that led to the equalizer. He got the ball, and then he did a Cruyff turn. He turned Ferrer, and then he crossed the ball to Hagi to hit home the equalizer. But that ball was at an awkward angle and awkward height, but somehow Hagi got his head to the ball and then equalizer. And then the winning goal, I think, was also something special. It was a free kick. I think at that time, the Zubizarreta, the Barcelona goalkeeper, he was expecting, because that was a direct free kick, so he was probably expecting Hagi to strike the ball directly, but instead he played it short to Cafu, and then he hit it second time. It's like he played a short free kick, and then after that he hit as though like he's taking an indirect free kick. So that I think confused the Barcelona wall, and also confused Zubizarreta, because he didn't really move. He just watched the ball just flew into the net. So in terms of the 93 between again Sao Paulo and Milan, that match was a bit more even. I would say both sides had scoring. Milan had scoring chances, also Sao Paulo also had scoring chances, but in the end I think Sao Paulo was more clinical in front of goal, so they beat They won 3-2, and it was a Milan team, a Fabio Capello's a Milan team that has gone 58 match unbeaten in Serie A. So, so again, for Dallas team to beat that Milan again, it was really very, very impressive.
And Milan was there only because of Marseille.
Right. They okay, and yeah, back to the point. Ras, Milan wasn't supposed to be there because Marseille was the
disqualified.
Marseille won the Champions League that season. So Marseille was supposed to be the team that plays Sao Paulo, but because Marseille was given a ban, so in the end, that spot went to Milan, who was the runner-up. So in the end, Milan got a chance to play against Sao Paulo in the Intercontinental.
All right. So that was the 90s Sao Paulo team. The 2000s, Steven, Boca Juniors.
Okay. When we think about Boca Juniors from the era, there are a few names that we need to remember. The first name is the president, Mauricio Macri, who would later on become the president of Argentina itself. He took over the club, if I'm not mistaken, in 1996. And part of his vision was to, you know, really give the club an uplift, invest in the club, you know, refurbish the Labo Morena Stadium and all that, and wanted to restore Boca Juniors' place as the kings of Argentinian football. And to do that, he brought in a coach by the name of Carlos Bianchi. Carlos Bianchi, I'm sure Javier will have plenty of interesting memories for him from 1994 when his Vélez Sarsfield team won the Copa Libertadores and running up into the game.
First they beat Dallas, Sao Paulo in the Copa Libertadores final, and then that same team beat Milan in Tokyo for the Inter. So Carlos Bianchi, Vélez team, even up to today, I can only remember Chilavert. The rest of the other players, I couldn't remember any of them, but somehow that team beat Sao Paulo and Milan.
Yeah. And of course, Silvio Berlusconi didn't help himself by making some interesting remark comparing Vélez to a Serie C team. So there you go. So Carlos Bianchi was brought in as the manager, and he was someone that had he was a very unorthodox Argentinian manager because Boca as a club believed in the philosophy of winning at all costs. Unlike River, River believed in the idea of champagne football. Winning 1-0 is unacceptable in River. You have to play beautiful. You have to play with entertaining style. Whereas in Boca, because they are from the working class area of Buenos Aires, they believe in the garra, which is means you know, hardworking, great determination. You play according to your strength and win games. And at that time,
like Juventus then.
Yeah, you can say that. Yeah. At that time, you know, Boca Juniors also was in a had an issue of its own because they brought in Maradona and Caniggia, hoping that they can able to revitalize the club, but that experiment didn't go on well. So, you know, those two players were out. Maradona retired. I think Bianchi didn't have Caniggia in his plan. And he had two important names in that team. In the academy, there was a rising name by the name of Juan Román Riquelme, a player that he saw that will fit in into his game plan to control the tempo of the game whenever he requires. At the same time, there was a striker by the name of Martin Palermo who was scoring goal at Estudiantes. He felt that he could be the perfect Floyd for every Riquelme's true pass to score the goal. And I still remember, you know, in the season 1998, where Boca dominated, 1998, they dominated the opening and the closing championship. And these two guys were heavily involved in every single game. I would stay up the 10:30 RTM news, which is the world news, just to watch the highlights of this of what was going on in Argentinian football at that time. Because the news somehow at that time was they didn't have the rights to show EPL and all that all. So they looked for something in the fringes. So Argentinian Football League happens to be one of their choices. I don't know why, but it was there. So I could get to watch all the league highlights and all that all. And of course, Riquelme, as I mentioned earlier, we saw already what he was capable of in 1997 on Malaysian soil. And of course, they were going to dominate in South America, and then they will win the Copa Libertadores in 2000. But I think the most important moment in that era was the Intercontinental Cup against Real Madrid. Because football at that time was coming into the situation whereby it was very difficult for South American clubs to hold on to their precious gems. Very quickly, European clubs will come and snap in. You started to see that most of the time the players will spend at least 1-2 years and that's it, off they go to Europe. But somehow or other, Bianchi was managed to keep a hold on Riquelme and Palermo for a bit longer than what you would have expected. Because I think, given the fact that these two players were already making names for themselves, by even I was thinking like, hey, why it's already 1999? Why these two guys are still in Boca? I would expect them by now being, you know, in Europe playing with the European teams and all that, just like their national team colleagues. But no, the
I think
important
I have
thing about
an answer for that. Maybe for Riquelme's case, because of his reputation of missing three penalties in the Copa America, so
no,
maybe
that was
that kind of like.
Palermo.
Oh, sorry. Palermo. Palermo's case was missing three. For Riquelme, maybe his style of play is a bit more static in terms of. Okay, true. He is a very a gifted player. In terms of his, but his play style is more static in a sense that European teams tend to prefer more mobile attacking midfielders. But his style is a bit more static and in a sense that he doesn't really is not your kind of like a creative, or I wouldn't say creative, but a hardworking. Even like for European teams, they want your attacking midfielder to also have a bit of mobility and work rate. But Riquelme doesn't fit into that category.
Yeah, you could say that, but he did excel under Pellegrino's Villarreal, who knew how to get the best out of him. And like what you mentioned, Martin Palermo's reputation took a bit deep after that Copa America.
Yeah.
And at the same time, he suffered an injury that laid him off for quite a long time. So he came back just in time to help Boca win the Copa Libertadores. So everything was set for the 2000 Intercontinental Cup. And at that time, Real Madrid was another team was also in the making of a Galacticos team. They just signed Luis Figo, and their new president, Florentino Perez, wanted to use this particular game as a launch pad to build the Real Madrid brand, because he knew that in Asia, Manchester United was the king. Even though Real Madrid has won so many titles, but in Asia, they are nowhere near to the popularity and influence that Manchester United had. So he really wanted to make sure that this game will be his launch pad. He was hoping that by winning this trophy, it will open the gateway to more things
Asian
for Real
fans.
Madrid in Asia. Yeah. But of course, you know, when you look back at that game, again,
yep.
It was definitely the two main protagonists that I just mentioned, Palermo and
I watched that
Riquelme.
man.
Yeah.
Riquelme masterpiece, really. He put in a masterful performance that day.
Claudio Macalelli had no answer for him at that time. And if you ask the Boca Juniors fans, they still remember this particular game more prominent than ever. And the Intercontinental Cup is often taken more seriously in South America, because
correct.
European clubs tend not to look at it, because it's like, you know, it's just another, you know, traveling to Asia and all that. They sometimes find it a bit leche la for themselves. But in South America, it's very,
I've
very
known
important.
Fans who even call that like a Mickey Mouse trophy. Like
well,
you have bragging rights to your club has bragging rights to be called world champions for 1 year, and yet you call that a Mickey Mouse trophy. So that's something I don't understand.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if you look back at that game against Real Madrid, it was typical Carlos Bianchi's tactic. You know, compact at the back, try to get the ball to Riquelme and hope for Riquelme to unleash that magic for Martin Palermo to score. And, you know, especially in that second goal, it's such a beautiful, it's definitely the quintessential Carlos Bianchi's Boca, because Riquelme gave a true pass from quite a distance and Palermo burst through. It was such a perfect timing, because had it been too early, the defender would have caught against him. Had it been too soon, you'll probably, you know, have to track back and try to get the ball, which will mess it up. It was just perfect timing for him to score that second goal. And I still remember thinking to myself, wow, this guy is back. Probably he's, you know, back to his best. But as you can see, you know, over the years when these two guys left for Europe, it didn't work out for them. You know, it wasn't really like their territory. You know, they felt they were Boca through and through. So sometimes when people question Riquelme's legacy because of his time in Europe, I think they didn't watch football that enough to understand exactly what kind of player he was, not just as a footballer, but what Boca Juniors meant to him. That in a Boca shirt, he will definitely show you what you probably have never seen during his time in Europe.
I think for me,
Palermo,
for Riquelme, the point to what Steven, I think you mentioned earlier, is he has to find a coach that knows how to utilize his talents.
Yeah.
That means he has to find a coach that really knows how to really build a team around him and really give him the freedom to play and relieve him of all the defensive responsibilities. maybe that's a little bit different from, say, Aima. I think because Aima is a quicker, more mobile kind of attacking midfielder. So for him, his style would fit a lot more teams in terms of tactical plans and all that. I think if you have a playmaker that is more mobile with more work rate, then I think with that, it's easier to fit that player into your tactical schemes.
Yeah, so I want to go back to Palermo again. I think he produced. You've already mentioned this, but he for me produced one of the moments of Copa America by missing the three penalties against Colombia. I've never seen it before and never seen it since. You know, and remember him pulling his shorts up in frustration and missing the penalty. And Argentina, you were wearing that Reebok jersey also. I remember that jersey, Reebok sponsoring a football team's jersey. You know, also very unique. So that was another memory of Copa America for me.
That incident hurt his legacy, hurt his reputation. In fact, he was frozen out from the national team for, I don't know, like 8 years or 10 years before Maradona recalled him back, I think, for the World Cup
2010,
and
I
for the
think.
2010 World Cup. Yes,
But
because
here's the
after
thing. Here's the thing, you know, the fact that Maradona brought him back, he scored that goal against Peru on a wet night at the Estadio Monumental. I think it takes away those 3 goals away. I think one, I it depends on which side you guys are. Some choose to remember a player from this side of him, but I will choose to remember from this side of him. And having interacted with many Boca fans, I can understand why, you know, him and Riquelme hold a special place in their heart. That's why they are, you know, no matter what wrong they can do anywhere else, but in a Boca shirt, these guys are untouchable.
Okay, I understand that. All right, guys, it's been a very insightful episode. Thanks for sharing all your knowledge with us. Of course, this episode is inspired by our Backpass South American design that we've released. It's up for order now. And also, you know, we've had our top tens. You know, we've been counting down our top tens on social media. You know, Javier always gives his top tens with Brazilian players' names and adds a
More,
different.
I think, okay. I have to admit, it's a Brazilian bias, okay. But
But no,
also,
it has a
I
bit of a different take to it because all this very perspective, right, on what you have watched. So, like, I name my top 10 first, and it's all based on what I have watched, what I know, my knowledge of the players that made the impression, and then also what they have won their career. So that's how I've ranked the players according to the top 10. Then you have come in, Javier, with your take on it, and then you know that sometimes the names you mentioned, okay, sometimes I don't even know who these guys are, but some of them I'm like, oh yes, this guy, I miss him. This was a great player, you know. So that there's that, and then where we did the top on the managers one, Steven spoke about two managers, about Bianchi, and like, oh yeah, I forgot about him, of course, because you see our again, like I say,
No,
coming back.
that's why my first point is the fact that if it's a Eurocentric list, then your
Yeah.
top 10 makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
But if it's on a global scale, missing Bianchi is sacrilegious, especially
Yeah.
considering the fact that Capello was his victim, Vicente Del Bosque was his victim. So,
Yes,
you know,
and Colossi.
that's a very strong resume for someone to be ignored from the top 10.
Yeah.
Although I
And
can
then we.
understand to some extent, you know, because his career was very focused in Boca or in South America. He never made like most a lot of South American top coaches, you know, despite what they accomplished in South America, they never made that transition to Europe. Even Scolari, for that matter, I mean, he didn't do well at Chelsea, did very well in Brazil, did very well with the clubs in Brazil, but you know, when it came to Chelsea, didn't do well. Wanderlei Luxemburgo is another interesting coach. I thought, you know, when he came to Real Madrid, probably he's going to be the perfect guy to put some stability in that Real Madrid team, but that didn't work out as well. But
Yeah.
that's why it's always important to look, if you to look at things on a global perspective, a lot of interesting names can be put into that list.
Yeah. And we went back,
The thing,
and we
yes.
did a feature, I think, last week on Bianchi and Tele Santana as well. So paid a bit of tribute to them. So made up for it.
The thing here is, well, I think in this part of the world, or maybe in so the focus is still on European football, and I think in terms of even the streaming, you look at all your cable vision or your ISP, your internet service providers or whatever streaming services, the bulk of the matches they provide is still European football. I think that's where maybe the fans' focus are. So for South American football, maybe at this part of the world, it is not as widely followed. But in today's world, it's a lot better because you have YouTube, you have a lot of like video online platforms where you can watch a lot of the South American, as compared to maybe back in the 90s and all that, where a lot of times you either watch those short footages from news, like or from like what you call it, world of sports
Yeah,
programs, or
full
from
of
newspaper
sports. Yeah, I remember that
articles and all
vividly.
that. Yeah, pretty much you don't really have that much coverage of South American. And for me as well, I think because of a lot of now a lot of online resources, I start also to start to dig back at some of the maybe teams from the past, South American teams, South American players from the past. There are a lot of you, I would say a lot of good links on YouTube, but for Brazilian soccer, a lot of them are in Portuguese. So it's either you need to have maybe some knowledge in Portuguese, or you have to turn on the subtitles and then have them put it on auto translate to really know what is really going on. Yeah.
Okay. All right. With that, I wrap up the show. Thanks a lot, guys, for sharing your knowledge, especially I think it's been vital. I think whoever's listening and watching this or watching this episode, maybe if you are a big fan of South American football, so please reach out to us. I would like to know other Southeast Asian-based South American fans. But on the other hand, if you're just a fan of football and you want to know more about South American football, I hope this has been an insightful episode for you. And you know more about it now at the end of this episode. So this is me, Russ, signing out. See you again soon.
All right, just
Cheers, bye-bye.
bye.